This podcast is sponsored by the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry. We work so that diseases like lung cancer don't control people's lives. We work to achieve a brighter tomorrow. Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily political podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and today I'm joined by James Forsyth and Henry Newman from Open Europe. Though recess starts soon, Theresa May and her cabinet aren't going on holiday just yet. Today, the team are going to the north of England. James, is the Brexit roadshow official?
So this is Theresa May is having a kind of regional cabinet in the northeast today. These regional cabinets, you know, they're designed to get basically a bunch of regional media for the government, right, policy. But I think what makes today's occasion interesting is Theresa May is off to go and do a Q&A at a business talking about Brexit, and you know, Downing Street kind of emphasises this will be kind of relatively unfiltered. So this will be a chance. This will be the question of whether she can sell her Brexit deal to ordinary voters. You know, the polling on the Brexit deal at the weekend was very, very bad for the government. It suggested that in a kind of three-way referendum, only 11% of people would vote for her deal, as opposed to either the two alternatives of no deal or remaining in the EU. So she desperately needs over the summer to do a kind of proper sales job on this Chequers plan if it is to have any hope, because one of the problems she's got is everyone in Europe, you know, reads UK papers. And so if they think the Chequers plan is dead in the water, they're not going to bother engaging with it seriously.
Yeah, I think these regional cabinets are a little bit of a gimmick, as James was suggesting. But I think it was actually the original intention to give the Mansion House speech in Newcastle. Yeah. So the Prime Minister does want to engage with different parts of the UK and actually go and speak more directly about her Brexit plans. I think exactly as James was saying, clearly the Chequers plan is bombing in the polls and people are finding it very difficult to defend. But equally, I think if you actually looked at the substance of it, there are some substantive problems with Brexiteers, undeniably. But equally, a lot of people would quite happily take something like a single market membership with tweaks. And that is really at the core of Chequers. So I think that the government could do quite a bit to explain why this is substantially better than the single market. It would mean no free movement. And they haven't done that. So the Prime Minister's normal way of doing things has been to wait a very long time and then give a speech. And at Chequers, they decided to do this slightly differently and publish a substantive policy document first and not give a speech which would sort of frame the reasons for the compromises. And I think her failure to do that has meant that the plan has really been defined by its critics in the media.
I think one of the other problems is that they don't want to sell it in a weird way because they think that would upset the EU. That, you know, as Henry said, if you basically went out and said this is a single market for goods but no free movement, so what's not to like? The EU reaction to it would be, oh, you can't do that. So this is part of the problem, which is they were so focused on trying to land this at a European level and not to present the plan in any way that to try and make the plan as unoffensive as possible to European opinion. That meant they've really struggled to sell us at home because they haven't actually wanted to emphasise, actually, we're trying to split the four freedoms up here, which is a pretty bold play and not likely one that is going to find favour with the Commission. I think that is part of Theresa May's problem, which is, and this is the Chequers, is compromises either work because they kind of land with people or they end up satisfying nobody. And the danger for her is falling into the latter camp. I mean, the other problem for her is that if this was a deal with the EU, whatever flaws the deal would have, there would be a sense of relief that there was a deal. She would be able to say, look, we've got a deal, we can now go on and do other things, we can talk about other things, we can get on with life. The problem is that this isn't a deal, so people are getting angry at the compromises, but there isn't any of that sense of relief at this whole process.
But also, the very fact that it isn't a deal implies that there will be further compromises, and that, I think, is almost the biggest concern. So if this was offered as an end state answer, I think many people could potentially swallow it. And I thought it was interesting listening to Jacob Rees-Mogg last night on the Westminster Hour saying that they were happy, the ERG was happy broadly with the Mansion House position. I remember at the time there was being a little bit more grumbling about the compromises there. But I think if this was offered as a final answer, it would probably be something that people would get around, because ultimately it would mean leaving the EU. And that's why I think that even though in Parliament at the moment there isn't much support for Chequers, if the EU did decide to tango on Chequers, as we get closer to the end date and the end of Article 50, I think its attractiveness in parliamentary terms might actually increase.
I mean, let alone having a deal, whether or not it's Chequers or something else, the possibility of a no deal is coming out quite rapidly now as well, with a lot of people calling it the WTO option. James, Amazon's waded into the debate. What has it said?
So the Times is reporting this morning that at a meeting on Friday with businesses with the new Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab, Amazon basically warned of kind of civil unrest within days if you ended up in a no deal WTO rules, whatever phrase you want to use it, scenario. Now, I think this is kind of one of the big questions, which is this, which is, you know, no deal was always going to be a very, very difficult thing to pull off. It was always going to be a struggle to mitigate against all of the risks involved. I think the question is, given that the government has essentially not spent the last 2 years seriously planning for that, is it possible between now and the end of March 2019 to get the UK ready for no deal in a way that could be pulled off without massive disruption to public life? I mean, I think that given that how divided public opinion is, I mean, if you go around telling people to stop buying corned beef, it's not a kind of viable strategy. So I think one of the arguments over the summer as the government comes out with more of its no deal planning, one of the big political questions is this really an option? Because I think you can already see how you could, politically, unlike Chequers, it's very easy to see how you start selling no deal. You know, we get to keep £39 billion, we walk away without any money, we're going to spend that money on kind of making the UK, you know, more competitive. We can, you know, with that cash, you can compensate the losers. But obviously, if just on a practical level it doesn't work, then that is a major flaw. So I think this battle over the summer to find out, you know, essentially, how ready the UK government could get itself by March 2019 and what workarounds there are from kind of other international agreements to get round some of the problems that are often cited and quoted is going to be one of the things to watch for in the next few months.
But I think it's exactly right that the government is ramping up its preparations now. It's just taken an unbelievably long amount of time to do this. The Treasury has been a huge block. And of course, the Treasury also has changed its position over the last few months to say that it wouldn't change its economic model in the event of the UK leaving without a deal. We wouldn't be Singapore on sea. But ultimately, that is exactly what the UK has to be able to suggest, that we would want to look very differently at our economic model if we couldn't reach agreement. Obviously, if we suddenly dropped out without a deal, that would be very, very disruptive. But we'll get a sense by the autumn, certainly by the sort of the end of the year, whether we're likely to reach agreement. And then we'll have those additional last few months of Article 50 to actually make further preparations. So, of course, if the UK suddenly left the European Union tomorrow without a deal, it would be very, very disruptive. But that's not the reality that's actually going to take place. We'll have those last few months to continue making the preparations so that it'll be clear that we can't reach agreement on the withdrawal agreement.
I think it's an interesting question. There is obviously a difference between agreed no deal, where, you know, the UK and the EU get together to come to some agreement on, for example, aviation to kind of maintain flights going and all that stuff, and a kind of hostile no deal, where the two sides are kind of almost on non-speaking terms. That, I think, is the challenge. And I think the danger is that we are accidentally slipping into that kind of non-speaking terms Brexit, just because the two sides are still talking past each other to such an extent in this negotiation.
And also, I think, not just talking past each other, but the way that the tension is being ramped up is unbelievable. I thought, the comments of the Irish Prime Minister about Ireland potentially banning overflight by British planes. I mean, this is nothing to do. There are problems with Brexit and aviation, but overflight is guaranteed by a completely separate treaty that has nothing to do with the European Union. But the very fact that he was willing to threaten that overflight rights would be withdrawn just shows, I think, how much a chaotic exit or a sort of a total breakdown in relations would, I think, cause unbelievable damage to geostrategic relations across the continent, exactly at a time when, of course, the transatlantic relationship is in threat and the relationship with Russia is in a very bad state. So this is a serious problem for the European Union, and I don't think they're giving it enough actual attention.
And in other news, over the weekend, Dominic Raab made headlines with an interview he gave to The Telegraph. James, what did he say?
Well, here he is. He's suggesting, and this comes back to what we were just talking about, which is whether there is kind of conditionality attached to this divorce payment, the £39 million. Now, I think the issue here is that the great EU victory on sequencing, right, was to do the withdrawal agreement before you actually have a serious discussion on the trade agreement, was designed to basically get Britain to pay up before it knew what it was getting. Now, David Davis, who's Dominic Raab's predecessor, always argued that if you were going to get Parliament to agree to pay £39 billion, that Parliament would need to have a pretty reasonable idea of what the future trading relationship would be like. Dominic Raab is going a step further and saying that he wants to impose conditionality on that money. I personally kind of slightly struggle to see how the UK will succeed in doing that. I also think that there might be another...
We should have done it in the first place.
Yeah, of course. But at this point now, do it. I mean, one of the other things is I wonder whether the kind of fudge might be to get a withdrawal agreement through, which obviously would give the UK the 2-year transition period, etc., 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 which is there would be some very vague words in the political declaration to accompany it, which would suggest that the EU was more open than it perhaps is to Theresa May's Chequers plan, which would help her get it through Parliament. But then because those words were legally meaningless, you know, essentially they wouldn't actually mean anything after that moment. But the UK would get its two-year transition, the EU would get its money.
So we'd have a future framework with a high degree of fudge, which would essentially allow it to mean many different things to many different people. To the Prime Minister, she could say, well, look, the European Union's not ruling out my Chequers plan, but the ERG would be able to say, well, look, it hasn't actually bound us into a Chequers plan either. Yeah. So it would essentially defer the problem for the next stage. Whether that actually would... whether people would think that was a, you know, they were happy to start paying that 39 billion, because of course the 39 billion doesn't fall immediately. It's most in the years of the transition, but there's another sort of half that's tailed off after that. It's unknown, but I think that's one of the things it's very difficult to predict. We've seen the parliamentary tribes shifting quite quickly, and the sort of the tone of Parliament shifting a lot over the last few months. So it's difficult to say definitively now where we'll be by October, November, when, if, you know, the government gets its way, we'll have agreement on the withdrawal agreement and some degree of future framework.
Right, so further fudge. Well, we're no strangers to that. Thank you, James. Thank you, Henry. If you enjoy this podcast, do subscribe, rate and review us. We'd love to hear from you. And we also have a special summer offer. Get 1 month's access to The Spectator online for free when you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/summer. Thanks for listening.
Disease affects all of us, but in the next 5 years, cutting-edge developments funded by the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry will change the lives of patients with blood cancers, diabetes, Alzheimer's and more. We are the research-based pharmaceutical industry in the UK. With over 7,000 new medicines in development, we won't rest until everyone affected by disease can look forward to a brighter tomorrow. Visit abpi.org.uk to find out about our work.